today's Irish Independent, there is a story. Its headline is several former Fine Gael ministers failed to show up for Leo Varadkar's decade dinner. Hugh O'Connell is writing this. He is political correspondent with the paper, of course. These members include Enda Kenny, former Taoiseach, and Phil Hogan, failing to show up for this private dinner. It was hosted by the current Taoiseach Leo Varadkar last night. It was to mark a decade of Fine Gael's party in power. Hugh, good afternoon to you. Thanks for taking the time. Would this be an unusual step for former ministers of a party not to attend something like this?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think you have to take account of the fact that these, notwithstanding the fact they're no longer members of the cabinet, they do have busy lives and they have other career interests now. Some of them are still TDs, but others, like, as you say, Phil Hogan, he's branched out as on his own as a consultant in Brussels. And Francis Fitzgerald, the former Taoiseach and Justice Minister, is an MEP who is in Moldova at the moment, checking on the Ukrainian refugee situation. And then there's Owen Murphy, the former Housing Minister, who dramatically resigned from politics altogether last year, who is now working with the Organisation for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which monitors elections. So he's out in Uzbekistan, of all places, at the moment. So Varadkar organised this dinner, I think, he said in the invite, to mark the 10th anniversary of Fine Gael in government. This obviously would have fallen last year, but the pandemic intervened. So he was trying to get people together, I suppose, to canvass their ideas and get their thoughts on what they think about Fine Gael after over a decade in power. He has spoken on this actually earlier today, where he said that there were 13 attendees, with nine former members of the cabinet sending apologies, six of them out of the country. So it's, I suppose, interesting though, nonetheless, that so many of them weren't able to attend. Some of those I spoke to who either were attending the dinner or weren't going suggested that this might be indicative of the sense of, I suppose, somewhat depressive state around Fine Gael at the moment, owing to very low poll ratings and a difficulty with kind of finding its identity in a three-party coalition.
If we focus on Enda Kenny, the former Taoiseach, as I did say, he was seen with his wife, you were writing here. That was at an event to mark Queen Elizabeth's birthday in the British ambassador's residence. That was on Tuesday night, but he didn't attend the dinner in Leinster House on Wednesday night, meaning he probably would have been in Dublin on Wednesday and potentially could have stayed for the Wednesday evening for this party. Obviously, I'm just speculating there. Maybe he had, other things to do on the Wednesday after he stayed the Tuesday night. Is it a surprise that he wouldn't have turned up, Hugh?
I suppose when you look at it in the context of the fact that he was in Dublin on the Tuesday, that he couldn't kind of stay over on the Wednesday, or at least show up or show his face at the dinner on Wednesday, I suppose it is quite a little bit surprising. But nonetheless, Enda Kenny is very much out of politics now. He isn't someone who's seen at all, really, in Leinster House since he retired from politics, since he stepped down as a TD for Mayo at the last general election. And he's someone who's very much stayed out of the public eye, notwithstanding a documentary series he did for RT about I think Irish railways.
Yes.
Last year. So he's someone who's stayed out of the front line. Equally, Michael Noonan is someone who we haven't heard a huge amount from since he retired as a TD for Limerick in 2020, and he was intending to go, but unfortunately a member of his family contracted COVID-19 and he was a close contact. So, I suppose that, those are more benign, I suppose, non-attendees. I suppose others like Phil Hogan, obviously, having resigned in very controversial circumstances in August 2020 as European Commissioner, off the back of the government being unable to really express confidence in him.
In regards to Golfgate, as
subsequently, this is over Golfgate and his movements around the country during COVID-19 restrictions in the run-up to that infamous dinner at the hotel in Clifton. His relationship with Varadkar has been almost non-existent, I suppose, since then, and he feels very hard done by. So it's not a surprise, really, perhaps, that he wouldn't, I'm sure maybe he was busy, but it's not a surprise perhaps he wouldn't show up to a dinner that Mr. Varadkar invited him to, given how strained their relationship has become since his resignation from the European Commission.
Hugh, events like this, is it common for political parties across the country to have different, get-togethers in celebrating their own success? Is this potentially a celebratory dinner, maybe one of the last, as you alluded to, for a little while for Fine Gael?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a great look when you consider that a lot of people, and voters in particular, would look at Fine Gael's record over 10 years in government and think that it's been a particularly good one, particularly when it comes to issues like housing and health. Fine Gael, of course, would argue a lot differently. They'd argue that they were the party that led the country or helped lead the country out of the Troika bailout in the early part of the last decade, and then facilitated economic growth and brought the country through the COVID-19 pandemic. But people look at their record on housing, and people obviously very struggling with the cost of living at the moment are quite likely to see Fine Gael as part of the problem and part of the reason why that is the case. And I think it's not a great look for the party to be seen to kind of marking its decade anniversary in government. It wasn't described as a celebration. It wasn't a dinner party. Described as a dinner party, but nonetheless, some people may be asking what a Fine Gael got to mark after a decade in power, other than a failure to tackle one of the biggest issues facing Irish society, which is obviously the housing crisis that is affecting every single person in this country in kind of different ways, and some more extreme than others.
Absolutely. And we heard CSO stats yesterday. Dublin has the highest average rate in terms of house prices, followed by Wicklow and then Kildare here in third place. Hugh, a lot of listeners may want to know a little bit more details in terms of any potential elections. How you, as a political correspondent, see the parties faring in the next one, whenever that may be. Have you any insight on when you think that could be? Will it be sooner?
The next general election.
Can we expect it sooner than we should be expecting it?
I don't think so. I think it's unlikely there'll be an election before there's one due to be held in 2025. I think there's going to be a tricky moment for the coalition in December when there's a changeover of Taoiseach and Leo Varadkar goes back to being Taoiseach and Micheál Martin due to become Taoiseach. Then there'll probably be a cabinet reshuffle factored into that as well. There's obviously uncertainty around the status of the DPP's examination of the Garda file on its investigation into Bradford's leaking of a confidential government document to a friend of his. So all that's in the mix, I suppose. But I don't think it's in the interest of either of the three coalition parties to precipitate a general election anytime in the near future. I think they'll be hoping to hold on until the last possible moment. And that's particularly the case when you look at Sinn Féin and its rise in the polls. I mean, consistently polling now well over 33-34%. And I think the coalition parties would be loath to create a situation where Sinn Féin might be able to capitalise on that, and they'd be hoping that over the next 2 years that they can tip away at Sinn Féin's poll lead and perhaps get back some votes for itself before the next election is called. So no, I don't see an election on the horizon anytime soon.
Could one assume that the three parties in power are almost in unison, as you've really alluded to there, with keeping potentially Sinn Féin out of power?
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, Fine Gael in particular, but particularly strident about never going into coalition with Sinn Féin.
Mm-hmm.
Fianna Fáil less so, and the Greens less so as well, I think. But look, their interest is in keeping this government going. There's a very ambitious programme for government, particularly on issues like climate action. The Greens are very happy with what they've got in that programme for government, and they want to try and deliver on it. So I think it's less really about keeping Sinn Féin out of power. It's more about trying to deliver on all the promises that they made when they agreed the programme for government 2 years ago.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. That is political correspondent with the Irish Independent, Hugh O'Connell. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I have my next guest on the line. That is postdoctoral researcher at the Health Promotion Research Centre at NUI Galway, Dr. Alina Vaughan. You're very welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Ciara. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Alina, do you want to just try and get into a little bit better coverage area there? I think you're just slightly breaking up on us. Alina's going to be discussing Ireland reaching zero HIV targets by 2030. She's written an analysis in RTE Brainstorm, and she's noting it will require, no surprise, political will, a rethink of our healthcare services. We've been told that's, been happening for many decades, and especially a reduction in stigma surrounding HIV. So in 2015, the then Minister for Health was Leo Varadkar. He did launch the National Sexual Health Strategy, At the time, his message was good sexual health is down to personal responsibility. But his quote did say the government can help by improving access to affordable testing and treatment. But since then, there have been yearly increases in new HIV diagnosis. The highest number was in 2019. That was 532. New diagnosis for 2020 was 444. Again, people can assume in terms of the pandemic, lockdowns, etc. That would make a lot of sense. Services not being open, people not actually meeting up. And in 2021, the new diagnosis number was 404. Now, the numbers are likely to be higher as services were affected by the lockdowns. And Elena, you've noted it disregards the fact that capacity to exercise one's personal responsibility, it isn't equally distributed among the country's citizens.
No, I'd agree with that. And the reason being is that, you know, we hear this discourse on this message around personal responsibility quite a bit in relation to sexual health and in health more broadly. And the fact of the matter is that there isn't equal capacity among citizens to exercise personal responsibility. Sorry, here I'm outside and there's a helicopter going overhead, I'm sure.
That's okay. No, you're all right.
So, if we look at the mapping exercise that I refer to in the brainstorm piece, so the Sexual Health and Crisis Pregnancy Programme did a mapping exercise of the availability of sexual health testing, STI screening and HIV testing in Ireland. And as we can see, the services are really quite overburdened. They're often very under-resourced. Many clinics have to, in fact, shut down services for a period for up to 4 weeks in some cases because they don't have enough staff and then to facilitate annual leave. We also have like quite a few counties, about 10 counties in Ireland, where there's no sexual health services.
Yes, and I'm just going to stop you there for one moment because Kildare is included. These 10 counties, Cavan, Kildare, Kilkenny, Leitrim, Longford, our neighbours Meath, Offaly, Roscommon, Wexford, and another neighbour, Wicklow. No services at the time.
Yeah, so absolutely no services. And I don't think that's been remedied in the meantime, you know. And so what that means then is that for young people, and particularly for young people or the unwaged or for people who don't have ready access to GP services, who may not have a medical card, who may not have capacity to travel up to one of the clinics in Dublin or in a neighbouring county, it makes it quite difficult to access testing. And of course, we know testing is a cornerstone of HIV prevention because that's, you know, that way early diagnosis can happen.
Yeah, and
people can linked into services and so on.
We've learned so much about testing when it comes to viruses over the past 2 years, much more than we ever would have known when the epidemic of HIV and AIDS did kind of first hit, I guess, in the 70s, 80s. But you have said that it's the cornerstone of HIV prevention. But again, there's barriers there in terms of accessing it. I have got a text in, Elena, on 0833 97 97 97. Alan has texted in, and I just want to know what you think of this comment. He says HIV numbers have been increasing in Ireland over the past number of years and is linked to immigration. Will this be part of the plan to tackle the spread, says Alan?
Well, I'm not sure it's entirely accurate to say that it's just linked to immigration. Certainly, there's some certain amount of new diagnoses will be people who have been diagnosed abroad and may already be linked into services in their own home countries, and they're counted as new diagnoses. But irrespective of the figures, those figures, there is still no improvement in terms of the overall new diagnoses of HIV. So it's still an issue, a domestic issue, if you want to call it that. But in any case, you know, anybody who has an STI or has HIV, but let's disregard HIV for a moment. If we look at STI figures across the board, they're rising. So this is an issue that, and any issue of public health really affects all members of the community, irrespective of their immigration status.
Now, if we're to talk about the existing services, if somebody has symptoms of HIV, how does one go about getting tested, and what's the system one goes through, if you get me?
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, there's various ways. The HSE have rolled out an online, like home testing kits that can be ordered online. So if, say, for your listeners, perhaps in Kildare, who might not have ready access to a free sexual health clinic, I think they should be able to order tests online. So that's one way of getting around it. And but generally speaking, if you know, in terms of accessing testing, you would go to one of the free clinics. There's various charitable organisations, so the likes of HIV Ireland, mm-hmm. Up in Dublin, Sexual Health West in Galway, for example, that offer different kind of testing clinics as well. So there are various routes, but it's also what we're talking about in terms of, you know, if we want to reach zero and if we want to reduce HIV diagnoses by 2030, I think it's really incumbent on the government to kind of expand services and to make testing that bit easier for people, make it that more accessible.
And Elena, it's noted that online testing isn't recommended for people experiencing symptoms. Why is that?
There's various reasons. I suppose it can be related to actually collecting the sample and making sure that there's a good sample for testing. Also, you know, in terms of the face-to-face services, this provides, you know, opportunities for different types of interventions and to, you know, facilitate advice on future practices. So there's various reasons why we'd encourage people to go and get tested at a face-to-face service if possible.
So in Ireland, the approximate figure at the moment is 7,200 people who are living in the country with HIV. And due to medications, it means people, you know, can live long, healthy lives, a normal lifespan, and they're not passing the virus on to their sexual partners. And women can give birth safely to HIV-negative children. So in terms of, you know, how medicine has gone, just like with anything, it's quite amazing. But if we're to go back to the numbers I was noting for new diagnoses in 2020 and 2021, so the peak was in 2019, the year before the pandemic, as everyone knows, 532. New diagnoses in 2020, 444, and in 2021, 404. So if you look at 2020 first, the guts of the first 3 months would have been without any lockdowns. So that number being 444, it's actually probably quite high when you think about it. Only would have really been the guts of 3 months when there was no restrictions whatsoever.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I think what we're seeing now is I think the figures for this year, now they're provisional and obviously they're not complete. We're only halfway through the year, but we're seeing a significant increase in the previous years. And that's probably as a result of the pent-up demand and probably because we were missing a lot of new diagnoses in 2020 and 2021. As your listeners will know, there was a lot of services that were closed or people were avoiding services because of the restrictions or weren't as readily able to access services. So I think what we're going to see is probably, you said we peaked in 2019, I think we're probably going to peak on that again in 2022.
Okay, very interesting. I know there was a survey conducted by HIV Ireland, who you've just mentioned, and it did reveal that 30% of people with HIV reported feeling stigmatised by family, 27% by health percent, that is, 27% by health professionals, and 23% by friends. What's most worrying there, Elena, is that 27% felt stigmatised, I should say, from the health professionals.
Yeah, so this is something that we come across quite a lot, actually. So a project that I'm working on at the moment is actually exploring this issue. So right now we are running a survey. It's a joint survey. It's aimed both at people living with HIV and people who work in the health service to kind of see really what the issues are there and what's going on for people. But certainly in research I conducted previously when I was doing my PhD, was one thing that was coming up a lot for most people that I interviewed was experiencing stigma of some description within the health service. So things that could happen would be, for example, healthcare workers using infection prevention measures kind of in excess of what would be normally expected. Some people were being, say, put to the end of having to wait until the end of the day to access a service. You even had a couple of cases where people were denied service or wouldn't be attended to. So this is, we know it's not necessarily a widespread problem, like it doesn't happen for everyone, but it does happen. And this is really, it's quite an issue because what we know from the research is that when people experience stigma in healthcare settings, they're less likely to go and seek healthcare another time. And so that can have adverse impacts for the health of the individual. But also, you know, there's this notion of stigma in accessing services, and that's going to impact potentially on people taking their medication, and it's also going to impact on people going to seek services who haven't yet been diagnosed, because mm-hmm. if they anticipate they're going to be stigmatised, they might avoid getting testing altogether. And so this is why we kind of really outlined that reducing stigma is a real key aspect to prevention, as well as to minding the health of people who are already diagnosed.
Absolutely, it helps the whole of society. When we speak about discrimination, though, in terms of women with HIV, you've noted that those who are denied access to IVF services because of their HIV status, they must travel abroad if they need fertility treatment. So does that mean in these other countries, which hopefully you'll enlighten me as to where these countries are, that they're travelling for the fertility treatments, but do they have more open minds in terms of less judgment than, would say, the Irish public?
Yeah, I mean, I'm perfectly honest with you, it's unclear to me why that policy exists in Irish IVF clinics. My understanding is that the same policy doesn't exist for people with other blood-borne illnesses like hepatitis A or B. And I think the argument that's put forward by some of these clinics is that they don't have the facilities or the capacity to store samples in the same way and store them safely. But I think that argument stands on kind of thin ground because, as I said, people who are on effective treatment have undetectable virus levels in their bodies, and you know, really is a very no infection risk. So it doesn't really stand up to scrutiny, I think. And so, yeah, so women who are living with HIV who do need to access these services are being forced to travel to places like the UK and mainland Europe to access fertility treatments. So that's just one, you know, quite, I think, striking example of the discrimination that people living with HIV can face. And really, there's no need for it in this day and age, really, with the advancements that we have.
Yeah, and especially just the general public learning so much more about viruses in general over the past 2 years, that we can understand viruses like HIV a little bit more and understand that stigma, I guess, shouldn't be there. Because there was stigma at the beginning of COVID-19 and in terms of who was catching it and what they were doing, etc. But this is how viruses, they're very tricky. They can get in anyway. As part of the UN Sustainable Development Goals and the Fast Tracked Cities Initiative, this country, Ireland, we are committed to ending HIV epidemic. Both of the programmes have set targets to have zero new HIV infections. That's by 2030. But Elena, there is a joint national survey on the stigma related to HIV in healthcare settings in this country. And you can go on to the NUIG website to find out a little bit more about that. Briefly, just let me know exactly what the survey asks.
Yeah, so as I mentioned previously, it's aimed both at people living with HIV and also at people working in the healthcare service. And that can be really people working in any capacity in the healthcare service, so both clinical and non-clinical roles. And I suppose for the survey that's directed at people living with HIV, it's aimed at assessing what kind of experiences people are having. For the healthcare workers, we are trying to capture things like, have they observed their co-workers engaging in stigmatizing practices? We're also kind of trying to gauge attitudes, beliefs, and understandings of HIV and HIV infection and risk. So the survey is running probably to middle of July. And we're hoping that with these results, the information that we gather from these surveys, that we're going to be able to use that to help develop guidelines to reduce stigma in healthcare settings. So it's really about identifying what the needs and priorities are, both of people living with HIV and of healthcare workers, and so that we can, you know, whether it's facilitate training or have in place policies that can support healthcare workers to engage in non-stigmatizing practices, and also for people living with HIV, I guess, to empower them to know their rights and to be able to advocate for themselves in healthcare settings. So hopefully, you know, if we get a good response to this survey, we can really do that, and we can start to make a dent into stigma in healthcare settings.
It was really lovely speaking to you, and so interesting this afternoon. That article by yourself, Dr. Elena Vaughan, postdoctoral researcher at the Health Promotion Research Centre in NUI Galway, is available on RT Brainstorm. Really, really interesting. Will Ireland reach the zero HIV targets by 2030? Thank you, Elena. HIV Ireland's number to let people know is 01873 3799. You can also email them info@hivireland.ie, and on the homepage of their website hivireland.ie you can see a HIV and STI testing locator, places across the country, including in the capital, in Dublin, Port Laoise, Ballinasloe, County Galway, Mullingar. There's many pages, I believe 5 pages of locations, James's Street, Eccles Street in Dublin. So if anybody wants more information, head to hivireland.ie. More text coming in on 0833 97 97 97. That is text or WhatsApp. And it's tropical in Newbridge also. It's 23 degrees Celsius there today. So if you're in Newbridge or nowhere, where the only place you should be, make sure you get out to the garden or get out and walk around and see what's happening near you. Now, I am joined on the line by Pascal Moynihan. He is Programme Manager with Safeguarding Ireland. Good afternoon to you, Pascal.
Good afternoon, Kira. How are you?
I am very well. Thank you very much. Enjoying the weather. There has been a call from yourselves at Safeguarding Ireland to Irish politicians progressing safeguarding legislation. You want the establishment of a new adult safeguarding authority recommended. And there is a report that was, the presentation of it was made today in Leinster House. It's called Identifying Risks, Sharing Responsibilities, the Case for a Comprehensive Approach to Safeguarding Vulnerable Adults, which includes the most detailed range of recommendations on safeguarding to date in this country. Let us know more about this paper.
Okay, thanks, Kira. Well, you're right. We met with senators and TDs and their advisors this morning in Leinster House in relation to this report. And this report has been over a year in its development, and it's a very comprehensive and detailed report that really outlines the challenges and weaknesses in the current system in relation to adult safeguarding in Ireland. And effectively, adult safeguarding is poorly developed in Ireland, particularly when compared with jurisdictions in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland and across other countries. We have no adult safeguarding legislation. What little safeguarding we provide, what services we provide, are vested solely in health services, and even within the health services, primarily within services for older people and services for people with disabilities. So there is no safeguarding oversight in terms of people living in the community where most of the adult abuse takes place. We have no safeguarding. Sorry.
No, just to let you know, we were speaking with the chief executive of Alone yesterday, and we were touching on the fact it was Elder Abuse Awareness Day and how vulnerable older people in society are and how legislation needs to be put in place. So it's quite a coincidence, I guess, the next day to be discussing this.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, yesterday was International World Elder Abuse Awareness Day, and just to touch on that, That day was inaugurated a number of years ago to highlight the issue of elder abuse. And unfortunately, despite the fact that it's been highlighted in many reports and many unfortunate scandals over the last number of years, we still have no adult safeguarding legislation. So the HSE brought out its annual report, I think, this week, and for 2021. And there were nearly 12,000 cases of alleged abuse reported to the HSE.
11,640 cases of this alleged abuse was reported to the HSE safeguarding and protection teams in 2021. And that's an increase of 10% on 2020, Pascal.
That's right. And by common agreement and by all available research, that represents significant underreporting of abuse. So 11,640 cases, that's 11,640 people who are suffering abuse or about whom there are concerns of abuse. And aside from those unfortunate, vulnerable 11,640 people, there are many, many more cases that aren't reported. And that's the unfortunate fact. For example, Safeguarding Ireland did some research in 2020, and that found that 12% of all adults reported having experienced abuse in the previous 6 months. And one third of adults reported having experienced abuse ever. So the numbers are quite large, and yet we have no legislation in place, no overarching safeguarding authority, and we still continue to frame abuse purely in the health sector when it's much, much wider than that.
And Pascal, the Safeguarding Ireland survey that was commissioned in 2020, what month can you remember was that commissioned? Because it was carried out by Red Sea, and it did find that 91% of people then did favour stronger safeguarding laws. Do you remember what month that was in 2020?
I think it may have been September, but I'm open to correction on that. Yes, 91% of people favoured stronger safeguarding laws. We have very little. We have no specific adult safeguarding legislation at the moment. And that's a significant weakness. And it's a weakness that fails those 11,640 people that were suffering last year, and more will suffer this year and next year and into future years unless we bring in legislation.
I really appreciate you taking your time this afternoon. That is Pascal Moynihan. He's Programme Manager with Safeguarding Ireland there. And to just go through that paper, as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, the Identifying Risks, Sharing Responsibilities report that was delivered in a presentation today to TDs and senators at Leinster House. The paper recommends the establishment of an independent cross-sectorial safeguarding authority, promoting, monitoring, gathering data, investigating, enforcing, educating and training. New safeguarding legislation, as Pascal pointed out, places an obligation on state bodies and organisations to take steps to prevent and reduce abuse. Removal of data sharing barriers. Onus placed on agencies to share relevant information when the risk is identified. And greater professional and public awareness on supporting decision making, empowering people with reduced capacity, using independent advocacy, identifying risk and when and how to report concerns.